For those of you who don't know me, I'm Noam Habel, and I have spent the last 3.5 years in India. And those 3.5 years have affected the way that I read the Bible. I have been studying the Bible for over 30 years now, and it's amazing that you can discover that you don't know very much. So what I would like to do today and the rest of this week is to explore an approach to the Bible which is still for me very much embryonic, very much in its initial stages. And so your ideas, your feedback, your thinking, your reactions to what I say are going to be helpful and important. Having lived in India, one lives with a world of poverty and corruption and a lot of things, as well as an exciting world with certain things that are happening. And we'll say a little more about that tonight in our worship service. So what I would like to do is to read the Bible, if we can. Try and read the Bible, please, from the bottom. Now I need to explain what that means. What does it mean to try and read the Bible from the bottom? Nor am I saying that I'm the only one or the first person to have done this. There are people who are searching to do just this in various books and various articles that you will read. And there's quite a lot of it being done in India itself. But most of the books that are being written in India are simply not available in this country. They are writing inside of their own circle. The people in the local communities are writing. But they don't get the press that the Latin American books on liberation theology do, or the books from South America or Africa, and so on. So, what I'd like to do is to set the stage to try and help us understand what it might mean if we were to try and read the Bible from the bottom. Most of society can be, in most countries, can be split up, if you have a pen that writes. See how this one works, right. Split up into a traditional pyramid, and I won't vouch for the accuracy of exactly these figures, but roughly there is 5% of the world which are the elite. I'll talk about those in a moment. And there may be about 15% who are so-called middle class, and that's been growing a little bit. And then there's 80% who could be classified roughly as the lower percentile, or the lower class, or if you will, in more precise terms, perhaps the poor. Now, generally speaking, the poor can be divided into those who have some education, that may only be to sixth grade or whatever, but some education, and then a vast amount that are the illiterate of the world. Now, you could perhaps debate the figures a little bit, but roughly that's the way it is across the world. Now, those of us who are here in this room, most of you will probably have gone to college. A few, one or two, may not have. If you have gone to college, then you are probably then one of this top 5% of the world. Now, because you're part of that top 5%, you have a particular status and you have a particular power and position that is going to affect the way you read the Bible. Now, for the sake of simplistic argument, I will divide the elite of the world into three groups. First of all, there are the educated elite, to which you belong. They are the people who are the teachers and the politicians and the so on. And the educated elite are the ones who have a lot to say about running countries and so on. Then there are the economic elite, those who have the power, the finances, and can control the destiny of many nations because they do have the economic power and the resources. The third one are the religious elite, which probably constitute half of that 5%. Now, every one of these elite groups controls something, or try to, anyway. Right? Now, not everybody succeeds perfectly. Every once in a while there is a revolution. But generally speaking, they are the ones who control things. Now, I am one of the religious elite, that top 0.5% of the world. And there probably are a few other clergymen. Bill Obrock's another one of the religious elite of the world, that top 0.5%. And every one of these tries to control something, or does control something. Now, the religious elite of the world control two important things over the history of the church. Either they have tried to control doctrine, or they have tried to control scripture. How do you interpret it? That may not have been conscious even, but you have a specialist, right? So you go to a seminary, and the seminary teacher teaches the pastor, and the pastor then teaches you, and so it goes down the line. And the Sunday school teacher is supposed to accept it all. Well, once in a while they don't. Now this is important, because if you are part of this group who are the elite, then you are the one who is controlling, to all intents and purposes, the way you want to hear the vast masses of the world, of the people, how they should interpret their religion. Now, this is true whether you or not you happen to be a Christian clergyman, or a Hindu priest, or a Buddhist priest, or whatever. It's still true. Now, for our purposes, just so that we understand this a little bit better, one of the important things that has happened is that because we are part of this elite with power, we have somehow controlled poverty in the world. We have kept the poor poor by virtue of the way we have promoted certain doctrines and interpreted certain scriptures. Right, what's an example of a doctrine of the church whereby the poor are kept poor?
The poor we have with us always.
Right, now that's an interpretation of a particular passage which Jesus said, for me you can give alabaster ointment and the richest things and build big cathedrals and do all these fantastic things for me, because after all the poor you'll always have. So therefore we accept it as automatic. What are the doctrines?
Give unto Caesar.
Right, yes. Yeah, the doctrine of the two kingdoms, to some extent, that's why they say that, all right? Give unto Caesar, there's the state and all the stuff that belongs to the state, and the church has its own world, and it doesn't matter whether you're poor or rich, right? We all belong to that kingdom, and you get your reward with.
In heaven.
Right. Your reward is in heaven. So suffer, kid, it's all right, don't worry if you're dying or suffering or poor or all the rest of it, your reward is in heaven. Now, it's not said crassly like that. But to all intents and purposes, the doctrine of heaven has become a real problem. There is no doctrine of heaven in the Old Testament. When people die, they all go to the same place. There is no sense in which you will be rewarded in heaven for your suffering here on earth. That only comes really with in the testamental period, after the exile. There's no doctrine of reward in the Old Testament, of heavenly reward. So it's an interesting kind of doctrine that we use, which helps to keep the poor poor. What's another one?
Work hard and you might prosper, and if you don't prosper, then you must not be working hard.
Right. Which ties into the whole Protestant ethic. If you have worked hard, you will prosper. It just doesn't work that way. You tell a coolie who works from 6 a.m. till 10 p.m. at night carrying stones in India that if he works hard, he will prosper. Rubbish. No way he's going to prosper. But that doctrine, which we have promulgated inside of Christianity and also other religions, in Hinduism is a very powerful doctrine, which is the doctrine of reincarnation. Right? There's no way you can get out of your caste and your slot as one of the poor and rejected in this life. If you live a good life now, you might get your reward in the next reincarnation. And then the next one, and the next one. So you are kept in your social caste until your next reincarnation. And there's no way you're going to get out of it. So to some extent, we've got a problem in that the doctrines and the interpretation of Scripture has been by this group, and relatively rarely people of this group have had any say as to what it means. Now, I'm asking the question, is it possible for us, who are all up here in that group, we're all in that top 5%, 10%, maybe some of us here, can we possibly try and put ourselves in a different pair of shoes and read the Bible aware of a different perspective? Perspective of those people who are poor and who are oppressed or who are suffering. Is that possible? Now, I'm not saying that it's going to be easy, nor am I saying that it's simple for me. I am going to try it, and I want to try it with you to see what happens. I can still remember when we had the great dialogue with the black theologians and the great struggles. They were saying, you guys are not black, you can't really be in our shoes, so we will tell you, you listen, which was fine. In the case of the black theologians, they were educated people. They were educated blacks who were really sensitizing us to what was going on. In this situation, we are quite different. We are a group of whites, of elite people, who are here trying to struggle to understand whether or not we have not had blinkers on when we have read the scriptures, because we have read it from the perspective of the people in power and the people who have this status in society. That's what I'm asking. Questions? Okay, is that clear so far? Now, if we do this, I'm going to put one more postulate, one more concern before we go into a text. When our revered father, Martin Luther, was concerned about liberating the Bible, you remember he translated the Bible into German. And at least the way I remember my church history, the story was that it was done so that the ordinary people could now read the Bible. And that's probably true. The ordinary people can read it in German. That was important as a step forward. But in the history of Lutheranism and Protestantism, what tended to happen was that it was still the elite, the theologians, the pastors, and there wasn't that much of what I would say influence of the real lay people in how you interpret the Bible, how you read the Bible. Some points here and there. The principle was a valid one. Now, when Luther did all of his massive interpretation of the Bible, and you go to the Lutheran confessions and see where the principles are, he had focused on a particular center for Scripture, which came to be the hallmark of Protestant interpretation in its ancient studies in the confessions, and that doctrine, which was the central doctrine, was the doctrine of justification by faith. And the interpretation of the confessions and the other great texts was based on adjusting to, reading the whole of the text somehow in the light of this as the governing center, the determining principle for how you read the rest of the Bible. Fine. I have no objection to that particular doctrine. It's one of the fundamental doctrines of my life. One of the things about it, however, is that most of us have seen that particular doctrine in terms of the individual. My individual standing before the throne of God, the court of heaven, and being declared righteous even though I am unrighteous. And each one of us stands there alone. And it's pretty much an individualistic doctrine. It got related to the doctrine of the church, but it's still fundamentally me and God. No man can save me other than me myself, or God can do my salvation for me. Now, what if, as a way of trying to reread the scripture, we suggested that the center was slightly different? Not denying that particular doctrine, but that you worded it somewhat differently. In the light of the kind of things that people have been saying, that God suggests this as a center. I'm not saying that it's a naive doctrinal formulation. God, Christ, is that he identifies with the poor. That just as he did with the slaves in Egypt and at other points, that's fundamental. And those people who are trying to develop a theology of poverty in India are essentially saying, that's the way you find God. That's the way you hear and read the scriptures. From the point of view that God is with, on the side of, working for, suffering with the poor. And the poor is a fairly broad term. Questions? That's a communal statement as well. It's not just each individual poor, but the poor. Now what I'd like to do is to go from this point to take a look at some texts and see over the course of the week whether there are some new insights that we can get if we ask questions with this as a kind of governing center, with an awareness that we are one of this social elite, that the people in the text in many cases may be here, or that if we want to understand it from the point of people here, what does it say? Does it say the same thing that we've always heard? Questions? Yes?
The problem, or not the problem, the question I have is, what is good about God, Christ, suffering for the poor? Was that helpful to the Jews to know that God was suffering with them while they went to the gas chamber?
It was afterwards.
Afterwards.
After the event, it's an important statement.
Okay.
And the people like Bonhoeffer who were saying, God, if God is not suffering here, then God isn't. And there are a number of statements of people from Auschwitz and others that say something essentially like that. That's where God was. He wasn't with those in power. He was there. And just like the cry went out from the cross, you know, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And the people saying, if God was God, why doesn't he bring him down from the cross? Right? God is on the cross in this language. Not rescuing people from the suffering by some deus ex machina, some kind of miraculous means, but is going through the process of suffering towards a new life. And so if God is suffering with the poor towards justice and peace and hope,
so we're not saying that it's God's good idea that the poor suffer.
No, but we're saying that God, because he is that kind of God, doesn't sit here and pass judgment there, but is here and passes judgment that way if he's going to be passing judgment. Good. Any other comments? Suggestions? All right. Now I'd like to go to a text which has been discussed by people from a variety of perspectives. It's a story about Hagar, who is the other wife of Abraham. Now, if you want to, you could, of course, say she was not his wife, but let's, for the moment, assume that she is, because at least they had a child. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 21. I'm sorry, 16. Genesis chapter 16. And as we read the text, ask the question of what it would be like if you were reading this as a maid, as a female servant. If you were reading it as if you were from the point of view of somebody who is in the shoes of Hagar. Now, it's interesting, at our worship service yesterday, we talked about Abraham and Sarah. Why not say Abraham and Hagar? I mean, it raises the question, because the people that we're talking about, Abraham and Sarah, are not the bottom of the barrel at all. Abraham's got lots of camels and sheep and oxen and servants and maidservants. He's not one of the insignificant men of his community. He may not be Pharaoh, but he certainly, in that part of the world, has got some considerable status. And when there's a fight, at least the story has that he has an army of over 300 men ready to go to war. Now, however you read those texts, Abraham is not portrayed as the one who is the servant, but who has the servants. Right? And Sarah has servants also. Right. So let's start the text. Sarah, Abraham's wife, bore him no children. She had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. All right, what's the relationship between Sarah and Hagar? Sarah is the mistress, and Hagar is the maid. It's very clear later on that she's actually a slave maid. Where does she come from? She's an Egyptian. It's another interesting thing. She's an outsider who is a slave also. Now you often have, you know, later on you have the Israelites who are slaves in Egypt, and the whole story is reversed. But here, it's an Egyptian slave, and as a slave, she is bound to obey her mistress in everything. How on earth did Sarah get an Egyptian slave? No, she didn't bore by it. Probably, you remember the earlier story? When there was a drought, and in this drought in Palestine, in Israel, they said, well, let's go down to Egypt because there's grain down there. And they flee, they go down to Egypt, and there Abraham says, look, Sarah, you're a very beautiful woman. And you know, if Pharaoh sees you and he thinks you're my wife, he'll do away with me and take you. So he says, why don't you say you're my sister? Right? And if you say my sister, then, well, you'll be able to save my life. Won't that be nice? So she says, being a dutiful husband, sure. Meanwhile, she gets shoved into the palace, and of course God intervenes and says, hey, none of this business. But as a result of this whole fiasco, what happens is that Sarah collects and Abraham collects a whole lot of possessions, maidservants, servants of all kinds, and take them with them. So they come away richer than they went down there. So apparently this is where this maidservant comes from. Wherever she comes from, she is a slave, and she is a slave to Abraham. So right from the outset, the ancient patriarch who is our hero is having slaves. And God is choosing, and this is the part that's awkward, God is choosing the one who has the slaves, or so it is in our history of the Jewish people. Abraham is the father of the people, and he had slaves. Now, this slave, the story is about this slave, however, as much as it is about Abraham. Questions? All right, let's take the next piece of the text. Behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Why was it important for Sarah to have children?
Male heir.
Huh?
You need a male heir.
A male heir? For what? You don't need a male heir, you can always go heirless. Well, we're pre-Jewish. We're back in the pre-Israelite even. We're back in the patriarchal period. Why? Why does he need why does she need a son?
Because the promise of the land went to Abraham's descendant.
Right. God made a promise that you will be a great nation and you'll have all of these children and you'll have the land and all these wonderful promises, which are very important preface to this. So if you're going to have a promise, you've got to have, that's right, an heir. Now, he tried one trick with some other male servant, tried to get that deal worked out, that didn't work. So now there's no children, so let's try by having a child by a slave. Whose child was it supposed to be, this child? Yeah, Sarah's child. Wasn't going to be Hagar's child. You have this child so that I will have a child. Right? So there is, I mean, the slave has no rights. Just because you have a child doesn't mean it's yours if it's in that household. It can be taken over by the mistress of the house. So she was going to have a child through a slave, or take the child, slave's child, and make it the child of the promise. That's the way the story is going to work, and God doesn't say no at this point. Because after all, it will be Sarah's child. And Abraham, she says, let me read that again. The Lord has prevented me from having children. Go into my maid, that it may be that I shall obtain a child by her. It's to be Sarah's child. She owns the slave, so she owns the child. Simple as that. What if you were the maid? You say, well, that ain't fair. Where is God in all of this? So verse 3. After Abraham had, a bit back of it, Abraham hearkened to the voice of Sarah. He says, oh, okay, sounds a nice idea. So I, Abraham, lived there for another 10 years, and Hagar, the Egyptian, the maid, was given to Abraham as a wife. And she went into, he went into Hagar, and she conceived and had a child. Now that's fairly straightforward. But what happens when a slave gets a child and the mistress doesn't get the child? It says that she looked with contempt on her mistress. Now, there are various ways of interpreting the word contempt. I mean, it's understandable that the slave would feel a measure of pride and say, look what I did. On the other hand, you have to understand that Sarah is hardly without blame in this whole story. She sets it up to be a problem. And in my opinion, Sarah is something of a problem all the way through this whole story. She gets worse and worse as the story goes on. Well, the one little mistake, it seems, the one little negative thing in the character of Hagar is that she felt a measure of pride having gotten this son for the heir. And therefore, a little conflict developed between her and the mistress. Very understandable if you've ever had a slave. I don't know how many of you had a slave, but when you're in India, you have a servant. Now, we never expected when we went to India we would have a servant. After all is said and done, I mean, it was completely repulsive to me at first. And yet, when you're there, not a slave, it's actually a servant, to have a cook, it simply was vast numbers of people who needed to have a job. If the girl that we had didn't have a job with us, she would have been carrying wood on her head for $1 a day. It's just inevitable that you are a source of income for these people. Now that's very different perhaps, but what my point is here is that their conflict between the mistress and the maid is an easy enough one to understand. Now Sarah, of course, when she saw this, said, well look, Abraham, now I've got this maid who's got this baby, and she's not, I mean, I'm not too happy about this, Abraham. See what you've done? Look at the trouble you've caused. She turns it back on him and says, all right, the Lord judge between me and you. See who's right and wrong in this whole business. Abraham used to say, so Abraham says, you do what you like. Do what you like, honey. And she says, all right, out of that. So because the mistress has the power, she can throw the maid out. Now, if you're on the side of the maid, if you're listening as a maid, you understand that. The power is there, and she can be thrown out. Now, that's the situation. And to this situation comes the important, I guess, point of revelation of the story. What does God do? They're out in the wilderness. They are thrown out. The maid is out there. And what happens? Suddenly, God appears. God never has a revelation to Sarah. Twice he reveals himself to the maid. That's not insignificant. She sees God. The poor person sees God. The slave sees God in her suffering. That's when it happened in this story. And that's not an unimportant point. Out there in the desert, the angel of the Lord comes and found her by a spring, which is of course where they're going to have to try and survive. Realize that if you throw out a slave into no man's land, they don't have any chance of survival, really. for her to throw her out was pretty much to abandon her to disaster. She sat by a spring. But if you're a slave, you've got to belong to somebody. You can't make it on your own. You've got to belong to a household. Very unlikely that she could have survived. So to throw out Hagar and the child was, to all intents and purposes, to leave her potentially to die. Now, of course, God doesn't let that happen. And that's the point where God steps in on behalf of those who are suffering. And he says to her, verse 8, Hagar, maid of Sarah, where have you come from? Where are you going? And she said, I'm fleeing from my mistress Sarah. It's a slightly different picture. One, she throws her out, the next minute she's fleeing. So both sides are there. The angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress, go back. What does that mean? Go back and be a slave. Is that the nice thing for God to say? Because if you're a slave, you know that going back, you can perhaps survive. It's a way of surviving. It's a way of, as it were, sticking it out for the future. And that's the way it's got to be for many people. Now, it may sound as if God is condoning the business. But certainly, that's a point that's being made, that if she's going to survive and stick it out as a slave, she'd better go back and submit to her mistress. So go through the ignominy. So Hagar goes back. Now, in the process, of course, before that story ends, having seen God, she names this well, and all over the place you've got wells that are named, which are all symbols of resurrection and new life and hope. Wherever you got a well, anywhere in the world, it means life. But especially in the Bible, these wells are places of revelation. So never skip over a well when you happen to see it. Okay, now she goes back, and I won't go through the story about the revelation of the name and all the rest of it. That's interesting too. Questions about this story. What we've got now is a story about a slave who has gotten a child who could have been the heir of the promise. It's being denied as the heir, excepting that Abraham still harbors that hope, by the way. He hasn't given up that hope that maybe Sarah will soften. Sarah doesn't. She's tough. Sarah's very tough, right? All the way through. She goes back. She suffers as a slave, and the child grows up in the household, along with hundreds of other slaves. He just becomes another slave, but not quite, because his father is Abraham. Okay, questions? All right, let's take the next step. I'm going to jump over chapter 17 because of the time. Now, that's the story about how the covenant is given, and that's a fairly well-known story. If you go to the story about how Isaac is born now, you've got to have the other son. The story about how the other son is born is really quite different, and you can have a feeling that, in spite of the fact that the Hagar story is a kind of counter story, an underground story, which is covered a little bit, the story about when Sarah gives birth to Isaac is really where the writer's sympathy is. He is very strongly in favor of the birth of Isaac, and it's a wonderful story. And rather than read it, I'll just simply tell you the story, lest you forget. It's a story about where Abraham is sitting in the heat of the day in the tent. In the tent, and nobody in the heat of the day walks around in the desert of Palestine. You sit at home and you have a rest until 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, whatever. But while he's sitting there in the heat of the day, across the hot, sizzling desert comes three men. There's something odd about that. And Abraham, you remember, is 99. And he can hardly move. And suddenly he sees those three men coming. And then every one of the verbs in that text is a verb of running. He runs out to meet them. He runs to get some water. He rushes to wash their feet. He rushes out to get the servant. Rushes everywhere. He can hardly move. Old enough to have a child, but he, you know, is very old. Then, when they come, These three men come, he washes their feet, then he rushes into Sarah and he says, kill the fatted calf. And gives a short order for his wife, 3 pancakes to stay. And these guys come, have their feet washed, and they eat, and they haven't said a word, you know. They're just taking it all. He's been the superb host, he's given them everything, he's handed all out, and he's a perfect example of the supreme host. And this guy, these guys stand there and they just eat it and say nothing. And I often say this, sounds like Americans abroad. That's not meant to be a bias of any kind. But very often people abroad expect to be treated this way. Now, then as they finish their meal, they ask the unpardonable question, which suggests that they are related to the people down at Sodom. Where's your wife? Not done. There are all sorts of innuendos in there. It's just subtle, but it's there. Abraham says, she's in the tent. And then they reveal that their purpose is not ulterior, even though there's a sexual connotation. 9 months from now, she's going to have a baby. And suddenly, from the back of the tent comes this cackling. Absolutely impossible. Sarah laughs her head off. She's 99. There's no way she's going to have a baby. She laughs her head off. And I said, you laugh. Oh, no, I didn't laugh. Sarah can lie through her teeth. She's incredible. So, they leave. 9 months' time, the baby is born, and they call it Isaac, which means the big joke, the laughing one. And Sarah later on says, well, everybody's going to laugh at me, fooling around when I'm 99. It's just not on. And 3 or 4 different places, different word plays on the word laughing one, the joking one, the sporting one, the name of Isaac is there. Now, there's a lot of clear sympathy for this particular Isaac figure. He is the child of the promise now. In spite of all the other efforts, in spite of all of the other slaves that were being made as possible as, the real son is the heir. And we live with that as the most positive value. We think that if it's the real son, it's better than the other son. That this heir is better than an adopted heir would have been. Is it? Happens to be the one that gets chosen, but should we therefore degrade Hagar's child? Or any other children that Abraham may have had? Because it's the actual son of this pair rather than the son of the slave. St. Paul has helped us put the one in a better perspective than the other, if you remember his discussions. Where do we stand with the other child? Okay, Isaac is born, and he is the child of the promise. He is the one who's supposed to be. Now, at the end of this text, where the child is born, I want to say just a couple of things, because there's a very important little reference here. If you go to Genesis 18, verses 16 and following. The three men, there's a little bit that follows this which helps to set something about the values of this whole period that is before Moses, and therefore I think he's saying something that's important. Verse 16, then the men set out from there and they looked forward towards Sodom. And Adam and Abraham went with them and set them on their way. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Seeing that Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by him. So now, Abraham is to become, through this son, the mediator of the promise and of the blessings. So Abraham ought to know what God is about to do. For I have chosen him, that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice.
That's a very fascinating expression, to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice. Before you ever get to the law of Moses, you've got a whole picture that Abraham is to be the symbol of the way of righteousness and justice. And that there is a way that precedes any of the law of Moses, which we'll talk about on Wednesday. Now, why is this important? In the next verses, you get a picture of Abraham as the mediator of justice, trying to bring about justice in relationship to the city of Sodom. God tells him now that Sodom is going to be destroyed because of all its corruption. And Abraham then mediates, and he starts to quote, if you pardon the racist term, Jew God down. From 50 to 40, he says, what if there's 50 people who are there? Will you destroy it? God says, no. What if there are 40 people who are there, who are righteous? Will you destroy it? What if there are 30 people there who are righteous? Will you destroy it? What if there are 20? What if there are 10 people there who are righteous? Will you destroy it? Does God destroy it? Apparently there are no righteous people in Sodom. But Abraham tries to mediate for those people. And mediating for justice as the way of Yahweh is one of the great and ancient principles that easily got lost all the way through the line. Part of the ancient covenant promise was that Abraham would be the mediator of justice for other peoples in the world besides himself. Now, is there justice mediated in his own household? Now, Abraham actually circumcised Ishmael earlier. So he was one of the people who got in on the covenant indirectly. Ishmael was 30 years old when it happened. I have heard that it's still there. Now, the last part of the story about Hagar, to finish this up, is on chapter 21. And I'll leave it open for any questions you want. Chapter 21. The Lord visited Sarah as he had said. And the Lord did to Sarah as he had promised, and conceived and bore unto Abraham a son at his old age, at the time at which God had spoken to Abraham. And Abraham called the name of the son whom Sarah had born, Isaac. And that's the story now. Actually, the child is born 9 months after the previous story. And after they called him Isaac, Abraham was 100 years old, verse 5. And when his son Isaac was born, and Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears about me will laugh about me. Well, that's true. And then she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah could suckle a child? Then verse 8, the child grows up, and she weans the child. There's a great big feast. Suddenly something else happens. Child Isaac enjoys playing with Ishmael. And Sarah can't handle it. We can't have peace between those two. We can't have friends between those two. One I've kicked out, one I've got to run, I've rejected. One is a child of a slave. And now he's playing with my boy, my Isaac. So what does she do? Once more, she kicks them out. Kicks them out into the desert, and this time they do expect to die. There's no question. They expect to die. Let's go back a little bit. Verse 10. So she said to Abraham, cast out the slave woman with her son, for the son of the slave shall not be heir with my son Isaac. There is always the fear that if there's that other kid there, he's going to get to be a joint heir or an heir. I want my son, I don't want her son. So you get Hagar's bitterness and selfishness, not Hagar's, I mean Sarah's bitterness, continuing through to the bitter end. And then, something that makes us is difficult to interpret is verse 12. God said to Abraham, don't be displeased because of the lad,
because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells. That always bothers me. Mm-hmm. Now, two ways of handling that. One is that God has got an ulterior plan. The other one is that the writer is really on the side of Abraham and has to and wants to maintain purity in the line. You can take your choice. Either way, she gets thrown out. And God seems to allow it. And goes out into the desert. And there she's in the desert, in verse 15, with the water in the skin was gone. She cast the child under one of the bushes. Verse 16, and then she went and sat down over against him, a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot. For she said, I do not want to look upon the death of the child. She's left the child to die. We know that that happens all over the world. You have to leave the child to die. People don't usually kill the child, but it dies. And here's where it happens. I don't want to see the death of the child. And then the angel of the Lord hears again. Verse 17. What troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Who does he hear? He hears the voice of the crying child. And then promises that this child too will be what? A great nation. Too bad, Sarah. This guy's going to be a great nation also. And God opened her eyes and she saw a well of water. So another well, which is a symbol of new life all over the place. And God was with the lad and he grew up and so on and so on. Now, God comes once again and rescues the child of the slave. God doesn't let the afflicted die, even though the conflict is there with the child of promise. Now, whose descendants are children of Ishmael?
The Arabs.
Arab nations. The Arab nations. Conflict continues, doesn't it? It hasn't disappeared between the Jewish and the Arab peoples. It all started between, because Sarah couldn't handle having the two kids be together and be joint heirs. Now, you can ask the question then, if God was with Hagar as much as he was with Sarah, is he still with the Arabs as much as he is with the Jews? And so on. We have always read the story from the point of view of Abraham and Isaac. We've rarely given any credence to the significance of the story of Hagar and of Ishmael. That God was with them as much as he was with the others. All right, I'll leave it there. Your questions? Comments, yes?
The Muslims consider Abraham part of their heritage.
Correct.
Do they have ill feelings toward him?
No, not to Abraham. I mean, the history, of course, they accept Abraham as one of their great patriarchs. That's right.
Yeah.
Sure. Abraham is the patriarchal father for them also.
How do they feel about Sarah?
Well, I have never asked them, actually. I mean, I must admit, I've never said, hey, how do you feel about Sarah? You know? How do we feel about Hagar? We've never said anything. Nobody's ever asked you that question. Is Hagar horrible? Well, far from it. She's a very different kind of person if you read the story this way and listen to it this way.
I feel stuck in justice towards Sarah.
Oh, okay.
In some ways as well. Because I'm sure there was a lot of things that Abraham did that maybe Sarah didn't agree with, but whether he would have gone along with them. Abraham seems to have gone along with Sarah, but come off as, I mean, to me it just seems passive acceptance and complicity. If you do the thing somebody else tells you to do, you're just as guilty
Oh, there's no...
That's my problem.
There's no reason to assume that Abraham is clean. Far from it. If I ever tell the whole story from the point of view of Abraham, Abraham's got a multitude of faults. There's no two ways about it. I mean, to palm your wife off and say, look, okay, you'll save my life if you say you're not my wife. I mean, there's a whole series of points in which Abraham blows it. But the principle is that he's supposed to be the mediator of justice. But it doesn't happen in his own household, even if it doesn't happen for the Sodomites. That's right. Well, I agree with that. Yeah. But neither Sarah nor Abraham are paragons of virtue. In fact, nobody is in the patriarchal story. Isaac comes closest to it, but he's a wimp. You know, he doesn't do anything. Very little. He doesn't get married. And then gets deluded by his two sons. Yeah. Sorry. Someone, yes.
What was the age difference between Ishmael and Isaac?
I think it's about, 13 years or something is about. At one point, he's 13 years old. There are different traditions, by the way. At one point, he's 13 years old when he gets circumcised. So it had to be at least that.
Originally, why didn't Sarah just throw Hagar out and keep Ishmael there with her?
I never asked him.
Hey, she wanted a child, that's what it seems like you should have. With
yeah, that's right. There's there's something in the storytelling that means requires that both of them experience a suffering.
When she first she's still pregnant.
What's that?
Well, in 17, when she got thrown out, she was still pregnant, so it couldn't keep the child at that point.
No, the first time she was thrown out, in chapter 16, she wasn't pregnant. This is 13 years. In 21, in chapter 21, yes, she has her own child by that time. But in the first story, in 16, she's not pregnant. No,
she's pregnant.
Hagar is pregnant. Hagar is pregnant. That's right. Yeah. I'm sorry. Hagar is pregnant. Okay. Point taken. Yes. Right. Correct. Any other questions, Bill?
Well, maybe just a comment. I appreciate your bringing in the idea of looking at the text in a community manner rather than just as individuals, because you're certainly aware of all the studies that have been done on these stories as really being reflective of political
yes.
antagonisms and political groups. By the time you've gone through the book of Genesis, you've had the Egyptians made fun of, you've had the Philistines made fun of, you have Moabite and Ammonite bastards.
Mm.
All of the Arabs here have been cast out. By the time you're through Genesis, you really talked about all the traditional early enemies and antagonists of the Israelites. So you got to clearly read it in that
That's way. Great.
But in this section, by the time you've finished with chapter 21, you have surprisingly mediated most of these antagonists.
Mm, mm.
I think the point about Ishmael, it's not only Ishmael who's circumcised.
Mm.
It says, and also all the slaves
yeah,
of the household.
Yeah, right.
So the first ones who are circumcised are the...
slaves.
Yes, the father of all the Arab people and all the slaves. They're the first ones who have the covenant.
Mm.
And by the time you're finished here, God has heard the voice, and it's ambiguous in the text, either Hagar's voice or Ishmael's voice or both voices, and says, I will be with the lad.
Mm.
And a couple of verses later, Abimelech
says
to Abraham, God is with you.
Yeah.
So it's clear that there's an attempt here to kind of hold up all of these group antagonisms and somehow to get beyond it towards some kind of mediation. And I think we really have a difficult time seeing that, because we tend to see this as individuals. And
correct.
We psychologize it for ourselves.
The history, these stories are probably written at the time of King David and that period or soon thereafter, right? And that was the period at which David was fighting against all of these different groups. And in order to fight somebody and destroy them, you have to, as we did in any war, declare our enemies to be absolute rotters and stinkers and have stories that somehow or another degrade them. And so the Ammonites and the Moabites and all these others and the Ishmaelites whom David fought are all part of the story. So these figures are not just individuals, but do represent these groups that Abraham was David was fighting. Now, our time is up, but if you did want to ever take a look at the story of Jacob and Esau, what I've done here, a very similar thing happens. And at the end of the Jacob-Esau story, you get a reconciliation between Jacob and Esau, which is very fascinating. The last part of it is really quite powerful because Jacob comes back rich as all get out and tries to buy off his brother with wealth. A real capitalist. And somehow it works itself out. And the story is worth reading from that point of view.